You're listening to Cast Erebus. My name is Christian Corley. Welcome to another edition of our very long-running Doctor Who and classic television podcast. Over the past few weeks, James McLean and myself have been discussing what happens next for Doctor Who. We've kind of started this conversation in kind of attempting to appreciate what the current landscape is. And this is an ongoing discussion, which we've already completed over on our Patreon. If you want to join us there, that's patreon.com/Casterbris. As I say, the conversation's already ended over there. And here in the public sphere, as it were, on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and all those other places where you get your podcasts, we're still engaging in that conversation. And what we're hoping to do is to generate discussion via comments from you. And so we can then revisit it in a few weeks' time once you've all listened to the episodic take on our conversation. Let us know what you think on where Doctor Who is heading and what its chances of survival are in an era where the televisual landscape and kind of the media landscape as well is very different to what it was the last time Doctor Who had a significant break. So this week it's part two of the discussion. This is around 30 minutes long. It's myself and James McLean again. We go through some other elements of where Doctor Who is and what other shows have been doing. The final part of this conversation will be myself and James looking at Doctor Who itself and what Doctor Who has already achieved and what it can achieve later as things continue to evolve and develop with streaming and other media, video games, podcasting, all that kind of thing. Whether Doctor Who has a chance with those whilst it isn't on our televisions. It is a realistic proposition and it is one that we do really need to accept and move on with. So I think this is a very important and interesting conversation that we're having. Obviously, I think it's interesting because I'm part of it, but I do think it's important as well that we need to take a realistic attitude to the current state of the show's production and its broadcast and streaming, where it is compared with other shows. So that's what this series of podcasts is trying to do. As I say, we really want to hear what you think about it. Before I go into the conversation, continuing on from last week's edition, please remember we also have a weekly newsletter. You can join that at casterbris.substack.com. Of course, the link will be in the show notes. Not only does that have a weekly newsletter, there's also updates when there's a new podcast out as well. So if you haven't subscribed on Spotify, please do that now, or on Apple Podcasts, if you're on that, please do that now. Then if you subscribe to our newsletter, you will at least get the notifications that way. And with that aside, it's time for me and James to carry on our discussion.
So I could imagine something doing like, like you say, a fantasy thing or a time thing, or, but would you imagine that it's going to last 60 years?
Yeah.
Not that Doctor Who was ever imagined to last 60 years and when it could, but I just can't envisage a landscape where that could happen now, where there's a market that could do that, the way that we consume, which would allow that, because we consume so much that because you think back to Doctor Who, when it started, you had just, three channels.
Yeah.
And then that's it. And then, that creates your consolidation up base, doesn't it? Which it builds upon. But yeah,
so is there a critical mass that things reach whereby they can't stop anymore? And is it a case that there isn't really anything that we can identify that's come along since Doctor Who? Maybe. I can't think of anything significant since Doctor Who that's still ongoing, in any field really. Maybe 2000 AD. Judge Dredd.
I must admit, I've always been surprised that 2000 AD managed to keep itself going. I remember back in the 90s thinking that this is going to struggle. I remember actually being back in the 80s and seeing there was a few gaps in my collection and was thinking at the time, is it finishing? Is it just not popular anymore at the back end of the 80s? But it's managed to survive. And again, given the market for magazines has changed so significantly,
Yeah, well, I think they went in early on digital, didn't they? I think that's been...
I think that definitely helped, yes, and how they marketed their back catalogue as well. They've been very, very shrewd and clever to manage such a difficult period. But yeah, it's the same sort of question, I guess. It's like, could you do that again? Could you do that? Could you do a 2000 AD again? So it's not even like you're saying, we're talking about Doctor Who is a very specific thing where it had a limited amount of channels which consolidated an audience, where there wasn't that much of that sort of show, which again continued its, and then it came up with this very clever rejuvenation process to its story and its production, which kept it relevant. So, and then that gave it its rod that kept it going. I mean, 2000 AD exists in a very different set of conditions and has managed to survive. But I can't again imagine a magazine, if we just go away from British television, go to British comics, who could do that again at this point.
No.
I can't. It feels like the longevity of things is disappearing rapidly, which is really sad when you think that one of the most powerful things that's come out of the explosion of media in the 20th century was the longevity of things, that you could see Ken Barlow as a young man and then Ken Barlow as an old person. It's an incredible thing to actually track a character as long as the actor. Is an unbelievable thing in storytelling, and that's going.
Yeah,
it can't sustain. And it can sustain in pockets, I think. So I could see Robert Downey Jr. coming back and doing, if the money was there, and doing Iron Man or any of those sort of cast members coming back and bring back the mantle, the same as Michael Keaton's done with Batman. Can see that happening. But that ongoing serialization, it's just not the space there anymore.
I was thinking, because we talked about 2000 AD, and I was thinking of Rebellion, and they have their fingers in the digital area and video games and stuff. So I was thinking of some video games. And really, video game franchises tend not to rely heavily on characters anyway. So even if you were looking at this from a video game point of view, and a video game series with a strong narrative and a long-running video game series, we've mentioned this a few weeks ago, Grand Theft Auto. I've just heard that Grand Theft Auto 6 is probably getting put off again to the expected date. It's either going to come a lot earlier or more likely later. So again, that's upsetting the video game industry. But that is a series of games that goes back to late 90s, early 2000s. But there is no narrative thread running. There's just running through them. There's just basically themes, for one of them.
But that's another interesting point, because we're going to the realm of video games where there is narrative themes. Like you say, take Dragon Age as a franchise. It struggles because it's... To make a game takes far longer than it takes to make a TV show or a magazine or often a movie. So, you know, you're predicting, the sequel will be out in 2029 or something. That's kind of, we're going down those levels of wait times for games.
Yeah.
And, you know, GTA 6, as you say, has now become a long-running meme, a joke that someone say, something will happen before GTA 6 comes out. There's that sort of vibe. So, yeah. That itself is, again, so it's not just, I suppose technology hasn't made things quicker in the sense it's made things shorter now. Whether AI is going to change that, I don't know. I think we're still too early in this bubble to see where this is going to go with AI. Mm-hmm. It's a very expensive technology in terms of power and, you know, where will that go? Where will it be profitable? Where are cultural tastes going to go? I mean, I saw a video the other day saying that there is a set of, which will disappoint us, like AI podcasts.
Yes.
There's a company which has set out, and you're aware of this then by the look in your face. And the idea is essentially that you don't need many people to make money on the podcasts because they cost so little to make.
Yeah.
If you get 20 subscribers for something which costs a dollar, you've made money. And that is a concern.
Yeah.
But then it's like that could be an interesting space to see where we are in 10 years. I think it will largely depend on whether cultures and specifically young people decide that whether something is human or not is a factor in whether it is interesting.
Yeah.
So for me, to listen to an AI podcast, to me, I'm interested in what people think. I'm interested in the creative and the cognitive processes of people. As soon as it's a machine it works differently. I don't have that same engagement, so I'm not interested. But if young people go past that, and we do know that sort of AI friends, AI lovers even, are things which happen, that might change the market radically. And suddenly that framework will make a massive difference to what is viable. But yeah, for people who are not into that, technology has not slowed down. And I'm not sure whether AI, unless it's sort of very embedded in the architecture where we don't see it, but just producing AI content, saying, well, we've got this, the next version can come out because an AI has created it in the next couple of months, you will see it, or the next couple of weeks. Whether people vibe with that, I don't know, or whether they'll just go, actually, I'm not interested. It doesn't feel real to me. If Doctor Who, like, so for instance, Doctor Who was suddenly being written by AI, would we care? I don't know if we would. That's the interesting thing. But would younger people, if they've been born into a world where that is the case, will they care? I think that's the interesting factor.
I was talking to someone a couple of days ago about certain TV shows, sort of the box set dramas on ITV or Netflix or whatever, British and American, and noting that it's very easy to predict what's going to come next. And whether that's because you're used to watching those narrative forms and you recognise the beats, etc., or whether or not it's because it's poorly written. There's two arguments there, and maybe both are true, maybe neither are true, regardless. But I think the whole notion of AI scripted television, AI scripted drama is, I mean, we basically don't know, do we? I mean, there could be stuff out there already that's AI scripted, and we wouldn't know unless it was specifically said.
But is that a bit like CG, where CG, when it's particularly overt, people don't react to it and back off? But if it's sort of embedded in and not noticeable, and it's part of the sort of pipeline of production, no one cares because they're not noticing it. Is that or they're not noticing it to an extent where it bothers them?
It's difficult.
I mean, is that where AI would be?
Yeah, I don't know. It is difficult. I mean, in terms of AI, I mean, we've talked about AI repeatedly on here. I semi-regularly blog about AI topics on my Substack. It's becoming more prominent in terms of, like if my kids are watching YouTube and these YouTube shorts come up, a lot of these YouTube shorts seem to be AI, or they have an AI voice. It's that same goddamn AI voice as well.
I thought that was something that YouTube was coming out against.
Yeah, I did as well. But I don't know if they're historical ones or whatever, but there's that one sort of, that one voice, it sounds like he's sort of like a 55-year-old Afro-American gentleman. That one particular voice that comes up a lot irritates the hell out of me. I'm getting off the point slightly, which is completely... Oh, yeah. AI exists and it's going to continue existing as long as we have the power to run it, etc. It seems to me that I don't want to pretend to have some sort of special knowledge into these things, but I've spent a lot of time looking at AI text because a website I used to work for had a lot of people from particular parts of the world where the wage paid for articles was comparatively quite high, and they wanted to maximize their revenue, their intake, as much as they could, these writers. So they were using far more basic AI that's available now. So I spent a lot of time looking at AI text. I know what it looks like. I don't believe... I mean, I've probably been fooled a couple of times by it, but the point is, in a creative world, it seems to be very easy to spot. For example, with music things as well. Its role, to me, should be as a framework for making life easier. We were talking about Frank Spencer's brother-in-law's house earlier. Now, AI is being used in some smart home applications, and that's where it should be. It should be recognizing how we live and just making things a little bit easier. These smart home applications are rolling out into kind of a residential group residential areas and communities, gated communities, etc. Controlling heating and air conditioning systems and managing sensors and alarms and things. That's what it should be. That's that's where we should be embracing AI, not in dirgy entertainment, which isn't entertainment. It's just kind of diversions, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's that old meme, isn't it, that I want AI to do my washing, I don't want it to take my job.
Yeah.
You know, I want it to do the mundane things, or the things which are require a level of processing speed that can't be done. So they could be sort of like in the roles of public services, where there might be something which, you know, like the NHS desperately in some areas needs to find new ways of filing its data from... Because as far as I'm aware, in certain areas, it's not done the same way. You know, AI could be, you know, a process in helping stuff which otherwise couldn't be afforded bureaucratically to do. I don't know. My point being is I think there's, yeah, I think the ultimate point here is that, you know, without sounding like a cynic, it feels like those sort of questions about where AI should be limited will only come when AI starts look when the eyes start take towards where AI can do the jobs of those who have the power to stop it. So as soon as it's like, oh, hang on, AI can actually, and it has actually happened, you know, where I can't remember, where was it, somewhere someone said there was a board of and on the board there was an AI, and it's only when you start getting to that point where suddenly people on the boards of things, or, you know, go, well, actually, hang on, my job might be at threat. Maybe we need to consider if there needs to be a certain sort of legal framework around where this is suitable. That's where I hope suddenly, globally, there might be a shift towards controlling. I'm sure, well, okay, I'm somewhat, this is one of those things where we've got to be careful about these days in our foggy world, I've heard from someone else. I've not looked at it so directly. And again, it might be in a sort of slightly different context from what they've been told. But we're certainly at a point where there's no doubt if AIs can, you can ask AIs questions and ask it to provide you answers and information in certain contexts, you're not far away from sort of saying, well, an AI could manage something. Mm-hmm. Well, it can manage something. So why can it not manage a company? So you get to that point, then it's going to be the people who will be iced out of their jobs there who might have a say about, who might have that political sway to be able to start.
But an AI in charge of a company sacks everyone and hires a load of children in Indonesia.
But of course, the reason it would happen would not be because of that terrible situation, but because the person had been replaced by AI. Seeing their job was under threat, would start lobbying to make sure that their job was protected. Because that's what it's, that when people in power are threatened, human nature means that they will change things. When people in power, their power isn't being threatened and it's something more remote, they're less likely to make decisions. So yeah, that's where things might change. And but it's hard to say, because it's that whole thing, and we've talked about this before, about sort of, you know, when things are sublime and banal, when some new technologies appear, it's very sublime. We don't know where they're going to go. It's kind of exciting. It's thrilling. It can do this. It can do this. So the nano banana at the moment's getting a lot of talk at the moment. Look what it can do. It's a game changer. Everything's going to change because of this new model. And then eventually things become banal and we actually know what it's going to be used for, and it becomes obvious, and we know what a pencil does, we know what a car does, and we know what a TV does. Well, you know, we know what telecommunications do, which we didn't know when telecommunications started. So we're still in that sublime stage where we don't know where it's going to go. But I think going back to where we were talking about, it's just an interesting marker of, like, where does that take creative content? And I wonder whether for a lot of people, if AI started writing Doctor Who, would that be any more canon than when people write fan fictions of Doctor Who? Some people might like the fan fiction, some people might like the AI story, but there's always that line of, like, is it authentic, is it official, is it canon? And maybe that will slow down that sort of pace of AI being used to write in those sort of contexts. I don't know. But yeah, just I don't think it's even about AI. It's just simply, we have so much content now. It's you know, it's suffocating. Stuff can't thrive in the way that they did. Or some people might say, like, a creeper. Maybe it's not thriving. Maybe Doctor Who's bad. The other shows could have been in the place where it was easier to put Doctor Who on, where there was a guaranteed audience. Maybe it's not thriving. Maybe, I don't know. But that whole state has changed, and I think that is sad, because it's the reason that we talk about Doctor Who so much is because it's 60 years of a show which has been so different all the way through, and yet the same.
Yeah.
And that's an incredible thing to analyze. But when that's gone, when those sort of shows are gone, and stuff lasts for six seasons max, and then is gone and forgotten in the ether of all these other things coming out, we lose that cool thing.
Looking at things kind of, you know, like pulling out the zoom a little bit, there's inevitably YouTube videos that are written by AI. And I'm not talking just, you know, just having some material converted into a script for someone to read, but more actual drama on YouTube, because there are like dramas on YouTube. Now, there's comedy on YouTube. I don't imagine any of that is written by AI, because I've seen the acting and I've seen this, you know, the dialogue and stuff like that. If any is, it's probably not the successful stuff. So I imagine, I'm pretty certain there probably is AI scripted stuff on YouTube, but it's very low budget, and I don't think it's going to have, because I think we know that the creative industries, they, and we have seen actors, we have seen writers striking over AI and technology over the past few years. I noticed a few days ago that there's a movie called Alchemize, which began life as Harry Potter fanfic, and that's been de-Harry Potter'd and reshaped into an original movie, which is in production at the moment. And I think humans are too prone, let's say, to write stuff that I don't think there is any credibility in using AI to write anything that production companies want people to actually watch. I think there's too much desire from people to write stuff that they're not going to, I mean, I could be completely wrong, but you know, writers don't get paid as much as actors. It doesn't seem to me to be replacing actors with CGI AI constructs would seem to be the more obvious cost-cutting measure than replacing writers with AI, is what I'm saying, I think.
Mm. I suppose the hard thing is, for a lot of where the AI, I didn't think we'd end up on this, low quality material exists, is where there are very few costs in creating that low quality material. So yep. Unfortunately, YouTube is a breeding ground for it. Yes. Ebooks is a breeding ground for it, because you can get an AI to just basically rip off someone else's book from reading it and then post yep. that up as an ebook. You know, there's ways of this really dodgy low cost practice, which, because it's so low cost, it means any returns becomes a good gain.
It's spam, isn't it?
It is, it's spam.
Yeah.
But the problem is, and this is, I think, is where we have a real issue, is that, and again, I don't like talking about younger generations, but I'm talking more about the sort of consumption habits of generations. So it's not a slight on them. It's just naturally, like, you know, our generation grew up on TV. Younger generations are growing up on YouTube. They're not growing up on television. No, YouTube is the base. And that, unfortunately, is the spam breeding ground.
Yeah.
So that makes the AI problem kind of worse, because it becomes normalized in a sense. That becomes what you get used to consuming. And I don't know what that means in terms of what that does to taste and what expectations of content. If that becomes your norm, that you're used to seeing that stuff, does that become your baseline of stuff that you will enjoy? So there becomes no desire to see stuff which is better or creative, because AI stuff is not, by its definition, creative. It creates, but it's not inherently creative in what it's doing. It's not artistic. Yes, that's probably the better term. And I'm hoping that that will be the linchpin, is that society hasn't changed so much. I mean, we're talking about a change in the last 10 years, which changes how humans have lasted for thousands of years, that the art of the interest in creativity is the human element. Yeah. Is seeing what humans can create. What could I have done, almost, is the sort of whole thing about art. Someone else has done something. Someone else is a person like you. They've done something that you can't do, but could you have done? if you were them, that becomes sort of almost like that relationship of the artwork, is whatever the picture or the show or the film is thinking, someone who's made of the same basic biological components as me has done this really cool thing, or this group of people done this really cool thing, and I admire that, I'm interested in that. And its frailty, I think, I'm interested in too. I like seeing that it's human. I like being able to spot that there's things which are imperfect or I can critique, because it's made of someone like me who is imperfect. As soon as it's made by something which is perfect or can just do the thing, that becomes uninteresting. And that's why I'm kind of hope that it's why... You know, in the 2000s, we talked about generations being the digital native, that they people who grew up in a digital world who just exist in digital spaces. And it came very quickly that those people weren't. And a lot of them were using just Spotify and Snapchat and WhatsApp, and occasionally going to, and that was kind of it. They were not digitally immersed. And certainly 20 to 30 year olds, big time creative crafts people, they you know, like books, they like tangible things. So we've always assumed that everyone's just going to become into sort of what digital and lose the sort of creative art, but they haven't. So maybe that won't change. But I still don't think, even if we take AI out of the picture, we're still in a problem that we have so much content now that nothing can thrive. So it's AI is an issue, but it's not the issue which is impacting on whether we would get something like Doctor Who again.
I may have mentioned this before, but I don't know whether I mentioned it live, as it were. My niece, Caitlin, she's my eldest niece, she's 21 this year, and she keeps a journal. I think she got it at a country show, in this beautiful sort of leather portfolio that opens out. And then she keeps stuff in it, and she writes a journal. She's studying to be a nurse. She's in her last year of that, and she does crafting at home as well. When she's particularly this sort of period now between semesters and that, and she's exactly that age group you describe, yeah. And she can, you know, she can listen to podcasts or whatever, or listen to music on Spotify, and she might have that on in the background or whatever. But yeah, she's very much a sort of into tangible things.
Yeah, and I think we like, as people, we like tangible things. I think also as people, we liked this. I know we rent everything now, you know, subscriptions I'm talking about when I say that, rather than houses, but then that's a thing too. But there is still a lot of kudos for physical connections. You know, people, you know, you look, young people still have weddings. You know, there's still a big thing. The big wedding is still a thing. You know, the going abroad is still a thing. You know, we're not in that state. I can't remember what film it was. Was it Bruce Willis one? I can't remember, where everyone basically has almost like a clone which goes out, a robot that goes out, and you just stay in a booth.
About
2008. But we're not in that sort of space. There is still value in actually going places and being physical. And, you know, maybe that will always be the case. We always assume the next generation won't do that, but that never seems to be entirely true.
The thing about renting houses, just in... It's nothing to do with Doctor Who or anything else we've been talking about. It always baffled me. The house ownership seems to be very much an Anglosphere thing. You just pop over 25 miles from Kent, most people rent. And that's been the case for decades. Germany, most people rent. I imagine it's the same in Holland as well. So it's very strange to me that Brits and Americans seem to be, and I think Australians as well, very keen on home ownership rather than renting.
Well, it's this notion, isn't there, that of assets, I suppose. I don't want to go into like capitalism thing, but it's certainly a financial thing that if I rent, that's money down the drain. If I own, that's assets that I that will increase in value. I mean, there are benefits to renting, and you know, you, depending on your rental contract, you know, your washing machine goes or your roof leaks, that's not an external cost. You pay more renting than you do on a mortgage by and large. But yeah, it's you're right. Certainly in sort of America and the UK, renting has a very different, and I imagine probably the costs and the way that the private sphere works in terms of that is different to how it works, as you say, France, Germany.
Yeah. But anyway.
But I think that, but that again is part of the problem, isn't it? Is that because we rent our television and our libraries, and let's be honest, we are kind of at the moment being forced into those spaces by the way the industries are going, that we are renters. As people who've worked in journalism and in the arts, we know that virtually all the software is now not to buy, to rent, unless you find public source stuff. And those renting conditions are shifting as well in terms of ownership, like when you have
Steam.
Or Steam, absolutely. So in video games, you don't own those games often. You kind of own the right, you have the right to access them.
Yep.
But if those conditions change, you could lose them. That in part maybe is kind of what kills the opportunity for things like Doctor Who, because you're in a position like, if you have a library of games that you can play and your games into that library, you're never going to totally stick with those old games anymore. I mean, if you see what I mean, because you're always on your doorstep, you're being, I mean, like if I wanted to go and get a new album, I'd have to go to a shop and see whether there was a sale on or whether it was in stock. Well, while you're playing the game, you've got a tab and you can see, or you're on Netflix and you can see the new thing which has come up, which sells you to go on to the new thing.
Yeah.
The old thing becomes less precious. So, you know, we watch Doctor Who every Saturday night because there was nothing else to watch. So that becomes its value. But as soon as Doctor Who is there and you've got 50 other shows to watch, some of them you own, but some of them are just being told that you could get while you're renting from this, the market and your opportunity to sort of make those long bonding relationships en masse, because it's got to be a lot of people doing the same thing, becomes a lot less. Less chance that you're going to become that nerd, and less chance that everyone else is going to become that nerd, because the new thing to nerd out is on its way. And unfortunately, because productions now are so complicated, the thing you've just nerded out might be another 3 years before the next season of six episodes comes out. There's 3 years of you to become a nerd on something else. So where's the chance of
nerding?
Of keeping that franchise going through dedicated nerding. Yeah.
Yeah.
People won't wait too long. It gets too static. They've got to go out in the breeze. So they're not going to
That's it.
Stick with you.
Okay, so that's the end of this part of the discussion. Look out for the next part. It will be along some point next week. And as ever, I'm forever saying this, but you must know this by now, that if you sign up to our Patreon, you get the show early, you get it ad-free, and you get extra material. Not just podcast material either. There's ancillary material from the history of Casterbus, stuff that was never really shared in the past or was just like used and then discarded. These things are getting a kind of like an archive, a permanent home on the Patreon. And we've got a 7-day free trial for you to check that out. So please head over there at patreon.com/Casterbus and support us that way. We'll be back next week. Until then, it's goodbye.